Hello, Matt.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Matt Continetti. It's Paul Glasters here. Nice to chat with you. Matt, you and I have been on these sorts of events before. I'm just for the audience to know, I'm Paul Glasters, editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine, a magazine proudly on the left. Matt, you're not proudly on the left.
No, I'm not. I'm Matthew Continetti. I'm associate editor of the Weekly Standard magazine, which is proudly on the right, and I'm also editing the Weekly Standard's Campaign Standard blog, which you can find at campaignstandard.com for all the latest on the 2008 presidential race.
And when you've had your fill of Matt's blog, you can check out our blog by Kevin Drum at washingtonmonthly.com. So now that the plugs are out of the way, Matt, I wanted to lead off our discussion today with the piece that's on the front page of the New York Times, and it is about Walmart. And what the story shows is that as a result of the campaign by unions and various liberal left-wing agitators and activists and bloggers and so forth, pointing out the failings of Walmart and how they've been stingy with pay, especially stingy with health care benefits, that Walmart has done something, if not quite a 180, then maybe a 105 on health care. And in the last year or so, has, for Walmart, pretty dramatically increased the percentage of its workers that have health care benefits, lowered the costs of those benefits, made them more affordable in a variety of ways, got rid of the woman who, about a year ago, it came out that they had a memo. She'd written a memo on how they could lower health care costs by making sure that sick people didn't work at Walmart. And she suggested, among other things, that cashiers be made to bring in the shopping carts to prove that they were in good health and weed out the weaklings. But apparently that's turned around. And so it was a very interesting story. And I wondered if what this shows is that the lefty anti-corporate types whom the right drive the right crazy can actually affect some positive change in their strident and polarizing ways.
Well, I think you're partly right, Paul, and I think what this shows is in effect the strength of American civil society, right? Because these groups were operating, with the exception of two state legislatures, one in neighboring Maryland, just not far from where we're taping this show, passed laws trying to compel behavior on Walmart's part. For the most part, these were just independent groups operating through a slickly designed media campaign. Anyone who was reading the papers or watching the television news would have seen plenty of articles over the past 3 years about how Walmart does not grant healthcare protection, labor protections, and other sorts of things. And so operating throughout the civil society and the media and in pressure groups, and not actually, with those two state exceptions, through the instruments of government power, they're able to affect what these groups deem to be a positive change, which was not more people, more employees of Walmart. It's the nation's largest employer. More employees of Walmart are now enrolled in health care plans today than they were 3 years ago. And so, to me, the glory of the story is that it did not require federal action for these outside groups to see a beneficial, in their view, social outcome.
Well, I think that's a good spin on the story. It's certainly the case that we didn't have any action at the federal level that brought this around. But, you know, the idea that government... That the liberal notion of government requires government action in every and all cases is a little bit wrong. You know, when FDR was trying to electrify the country, he created rural electric cooperatives and big TVA projects and, government instituted change. But what he really wanted was the private sector to do the job of wiring the country themselves. And he described government action as the birch rod in the cupboard, right, that you take out and you threaten the private sector with if they won't do what's right. And I think you're a little bit underestimating the birch rod of those changes in California and Maryland that were forcing Walmart to do more for health care. I think what you saw there is that Lee Siegel Jr., the CEO of Walmart, could see the writing on the wall, that already at the state level you're beginning to see some mandates that they didn't want. And if they wanted to head them off, and he could see where the politics in this country is leading toward, certainly in the direction of national health care, that he needed to get in front of that. And so he did. And there's another aspect of this that I wanted to point out. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but on the agitating side were groups like the Food and Commercial Workers Union and the Service Employees Union, Andy Stern's group, and some grassroots bloggers and so forth. They were the ones really putting up the pressure, creating the boycotts, doing the media events and so forth. But then they all there was also an insight game. Lee Siegel sought out the advice of people like former President Bill Clinton, a longtime sort of watcher and advocate of Walmart because it's an Arkansas-based company. Hillary Clinton was at one point on the Walmart board. And I remember running into a full old friend of mine from the Clinton administration about a year and a half ago, and she said that she was going to work for Walmart. And I said, huh, that's interesting, because this was right in the middle of all the anti-Walmart stuff. And we were right in the middle of producing a piece by T.A. Frank in April of 2006 called How Much Should We Hate Walmart? Trying to really take a clear-eyed look at how bad Walmart was really compared to its competitors like Target. And we determined pretty bad. They had a corporate culture that had really gone off the rails since the death of the founder, Sam Walton. And so this woman said, yeah, I asked President Clinton, you know, I'm going to do this. Do you think it's the right thing to do? And he said, absolutely, it's the right thing to do. And when Lee Siegel asked Clinton his advice on what to do, he said, you know, Lee, you could make a lot more money doing, you can make just as much money doing the right thing than the wrong thing. And that seems to have been the philosophy they internalized. So you had kind of the left Democrats agitating and making life miserable, and the center Democrats kind of showing them the way. So it wasn't altogether without politics.
Right, and one thing you do see in just the anecdote you told us is the continuing political power of President Clinton, who now, since he's assumed this title of global celebrity, actually in some ways I think commands even more authority than he did when he was president, which is odd considering we traditionally think of the presidency as the most powerful position in the world.
Right.
But Clinton, we can look at his new book, for example, Giving, where he's on, as Christopher Caldwell put it recently in the Financial Times, he's on the cutting edge of a new form of celebrity politics that is intimately tied with philanthropy. And so there, in the Giving instance, Clinton is really working out this inchoate form of politics about pressuring government institutions and these huge foundations, which have incredible pools of capital that they need to put to use, because it's their foundations, they're in their charters, they need to put it to some use. And so now we have a new form of politics about directing those institutions. To which purpose will these huge institutions or foundations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, to which purpose are they going to put their funds? Well, Clinton, with the Clinton Foundation and the Millennial Challenge and Global Initiative, he's at the forefront of that. And then in this Walmart story, you also see where he continues to use his political connections that he's developed over such a long career in politics to further a certain central-left agenda, which also, it occurred to me while you were speaking, dovetails nicely with his wife's presidential ambitions.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, Lee Scott now has come out, what this is about 6 months old news, but he is now supporting, along with the service employees unions and others, the desire for universal health care. You know, Hillary talks about the only way she's going to, if she's elected president, is going to have universal health care is if she builds a coalition to get it done. Well, they've already started building the coalition, and part of that was Lee Scott. You know, Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, I think it was, once said that the great conservative truth is that culture matters, and that the great liberal truth is that you sometimes need government to change culture. And going back to that T.A. Frank piece I mentioned, there was a time early on when Walmart had a terrific culture under Sam Walton. I think it got off track, and his view of the world solidified into a kind of dogma that was, you know, penny pinching for its own sake without any nuance. You know, Sam Walton went through a period where he was buying American, the price be damned. He had more of a vision than what ultimately was handed down to the disciples. And what I think is happening now is the culture of Walmart's changing a little bit because of these outside factors and a little bit of new leadership. And what and you know, changing the culture of capitalism is a noble and great goal. And you mentioned Bill Clinton. There was that cover story by Jonathan Rauch in The Atlantic a couple of issues ago about how part of what he's doing with his foundation is to act almost like management consultants to create markets for, say, retroviral drugs by going to generic drug manufacturers in India and China and saying, how big a market do you need in order to produce drugs at this low price? And they'll give him a number, and then he'll help those companies. His foundation will pour consultants into those companies to help them restructure to be more efficient, to be able to produce those retrovirals at that price. And then meanwhile, he's talking to the governments in Africa, saying, how low does the price of retrovirals have to be before you can provide them for everybody in your country? And they say, well, this is the price. And then they pour consultants in to help them figure out a way to do that. So it's and then his hope is that they can step away from that, and you've created a market, which was probably going to develop over the next 20 years, but through the efforts of his foundation, you can speed that up and maybe save millions of lives. So it's all about manipulating capitalism to do the right thing.
Well, I think I take a slightly less sanguine view of it. I don't know whether it's these agents manipulating capitalism as much as it is them reflecting the new forms of capitalism that dominate our global civilization. I mean, one thing that we have to realize is, as long as we talk about Bill Clinton and his entrepreneurial or philanthropic efforts, whether it's in Walmart or whether it's this story that you described about the retroviral drugs, Bill Clinton does not hold any longer Democratic office. No one elected Bill Clinton to start making these huge retroviral deals and inserting himself in the power dynamics of Indian companies or African nations. Mm-hmm. And so this is a new form of power that I think is interesting and certainly fun to watch develop. But it's also not accountable through the normal means of the democratic process. Like a lot of power that we've seen, at least in the American context for more than 200 years, and in a larger context for the last 50 or so years.
Well, I think that's a good point. I hadn't even thought about that. I mean, you know, what is the accountability for somebody like, Bill Clinton is one example. The Bradley Foundation or this Scafe Foundation on the other side.
That's right.
Also, tons of money affecting fundamental debate and no accountability whatsoever, but it is, as you say, civil society, and we don't really control civil society. We've talked about President Clinton and Hillary. The news now in the Democratic primary is that some poll data suggests that Hillary, the commanding lead she has had up for the last few months has eroded a bit, and although I'm not 100% clear on the data, on the poll data, because it seems to be inconsistent, maybe Barack has picked up some stuff, some support. Is that your Is that your read on it?
It is. I mean, I think we need to separate those national polls where Senator Clinton has held a pretty dominant lead and a consistent one for most of the year with the state polls, specifically the state polls in Iowa, where the race has really been a three-way tie now for some time between Clinton, Obama, and John Edwards. And now we're seeing data out of New Hampshire, which the pollster Charles Franklin of the University of Wisconsin discusses on pollster.com this week, that shows that Clinton may have had a slight decline since September in her New Hampshire numbers, and Obama is a slight rise. Now, Obama had declined earlier and later in the summer in New Hampshire, so now his rise is basically taking him to where he was at the beginning of this quarter, and he's now taking that those lost numbers, and he's on the ascent while Clinton remains steady. And what this shows to me, anyway, is that the Democratic race is by no means over. And the number that's always been the most interesting is whenever people talk about Hillary Clinton's inevitability, they always seem to leave out that Iowa poll. Whereas on the Republican side, whenever people want to downplay Rudy Giuliani's chances of winning the nomination, the first thing they mention is the Iowa poll, where in the Republican side, Mitt Romney leads. But we'll talk about the Republicans later. What's your take on the Democratic race?
You know, it seemed to me that her dominance for all these many weeks, even months, couldn't last forever. My gut says she'll still be the nominee, but that there was a certain amount of people that were parked there that were open to change. You know, I really don't have a clue what people think, whether they watched the final moments of the debate a few weeks ago, the MSNBC debate where Tim Russert and Brian Williams asked her some tough questions and the other candidates piled on, as they say, and whether her answer about immigration and driver's licenses was not clear enough, and so whether I have no idea if voters are paying such strict attention that things like that are what is affecting these modulations in the polls, or whether I really don't know. You have to sort of be out there, and I'm not following the race. I will say one thing. When I was talking to Hillary people back in the late spring, some people also covering the race, I shared the thought that I thought she did a really not good job of giving speeches. And they said, that's true. They conceded that, but that they would say she does a very, very good job of answering questions in venues where she can display her immense specific knowledge of the world, of the issues that she would need to deal with as president. She blows people away, or at least does very, very well, does better than she does in rooms full of people giving a prepared remarks. And it got me thinking, you know, the best headlines that Hillary had during her time as First Lady was when she was standing up in front of, sitting in front of Congress, testifying in the early day rollout of the health care plan, and you were probably in junior high school at this time, Matt, but it was in Washington front page news that she was able to withstand 4 6 hours of congressional scrutiny with no notes, answering questions in full paragraphs and with tremendous knowledge. She really did impress people. And what we've seen really since the spring is that the venues that she's been at have been debates, nine of them, and town hall meetings where she gets to answer questions. And she's done very, very well in most of these debates. So maybe the fact that she's perhaps having to give more prepared remarks. I hear she didn't do as well at the Lincoln, the Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner event the other day. You saw that.
Yeah, the two big speeches out of that Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner in Iowa, it's a huge event for Iowa Democrats, and if I've heard one statistic that said 9,000 Democrats were attending or viewing this event, which is a large portion, we could assume, of the voting bloc in the next year's Iowa Democratic caucus. But the real story that came out of that, of course, was Barack Obama's speech, where he laid a marker, I think, contrasting his personal style with Hillary Clinton's, what he viewed as what Hillary Clinton represents, which is kind of the old politics, the 60s politics, the baby boom politics. Whereas he is, truly represents, he argued, a real change from the type of polarization we've had in the past. But, you know, Paul, you mentioned something that was interesting, talking about these debates, and you didn't know what effect these debates had, these televised debates, or whether you said yourself you weren't even paying that close attention to the race. And I think that's actually true for most people, most of the millions of Americans who will be voting in these primaries next year. They still haven't really clued in. A recent poll in New Hampshire showed that more than 50% of New Hampshire Democrats haven't made up their minds as to for whom they will vote next January, and 60% of New Hampshire Republicans haven't decided for whom they will vote. So I think sometimes political writers, because we're so in tune with the campaign or the cycles of the campaign and the news cycle generally, we start assuming that every little gaffe, every little utterance of a candidate, every televised debate has some great impact.
Right.
And then, we can see that sometimes reflected in data. But I think one thing to keep in mind, A, that's not true, and B, I'm not sure how well Hillary Clinton will wear on voters. I think she goes into the race with fantastic name recognition, of course. I mean, she's one of the most famous people alive, or as Rudy Giuliani might put it, she's one of the four or five most famous Americans, along with him. And she goes in with quite a resume. I mean, everybody knows her, and everybody likes her husband, and everybody, it seems anyway, about 60% of the American public, a little bit more, have very fond memories of Bill Clinton's presidency. The question is Hillary herself, and how well does she wear on the voting populace as we continue down this extremely long and turgid campaign? And in some of these numbers where we may see a slight erosion in support, we may see more people, as her campaign puts it, piling on her, I think, evasive answers to many questions, you see that she may not wear that well in the end.
That may be true, but then how do you explain the fact that her negatives have gone down as the campaign has continued?
Well, I don't have an explanation for it. It's just equally as possible that people have a more favorable view of her than they did beforehand. I can tell you that her negatives definitely haven't gone down among Republican voters. One thing I would add, though, too, is, you know, this whole question of where does the anti-Hillary vote go, I think, is important, especially in the caucus situation. Because, you know, in the Iowa caucuses, once you have that first arrangement of people in the room subdivided into which candidate they support, they then do a second round where those who support the candidate, say you have the one person in all of Iowa who's actually going to caucus for Mike Gravel, you know, he or she's going to be the only person in that room standing in that corner, I think it's safe to say, for Mike Gravel. And so they have a second round where they say, okay, since you're the only person there, who do you support now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that pool of voters who have not already committed themselves to Hillary Clinton, which maybe not nationally, but certainly in these first two states, is relatively large. I really doubt that they're going to go to Hillary as their second choice. And so if the vote even breaks, you know, 3-2 against Hillary in an Iowa-type situation, she has a chance of actually losing closely. And then I think the Democratic nomination is wide open.
Do you really? I mean, do you think that Hillary absolutely has to win Iowa to sew it up, or does that simply open up the possibility of it seems to me Hillary wins Iowa decisively. God, it's hard to see how. I mean, Obama's got the money to keep going, but
right.
Boy, it's really hard to see that it is anything but a Hillary victory.
Right.
She barely wins or barely loses. Surely it's a race. She loses by 10 percentage points, then it's really a race.
Right.
But I think going in, the expectations are it's a three-way race, and she's kind of not that strong in Iowa, so I don't think the expectations are there for her.
That's true. And remember, also, New Hampshire loves to play the contrarian.
Right.
It didn't play the contrarian last cycle with John Kerry, where he won Iowa by 6 points and then went to that great victory in New Hampshire. But that's also because John Kerry is a neighborhood politician, and Massachusetts
right.
polls tend to play pretty powerfully there in New
that's
Hampshire.
That's right. That's right. So that's where your read of the Democratic race is. Hillary still, I would say, the commanding favorite, but Barack, you know, getting a second wind. On the Republican side, boy, I can't make heads or tails of it. What is going on the Republican side?
Oh, right now we're having a debate within the offices of the Weekly Standard about just what are the dynamics at play in the GOP presidential race. There's some like Fred Barnes who say, really, it's a two-man race between Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney, because only Giuliani and Romney have what you call realistic scenarios to the nomination. In Romney's case, it's that 1-2 punch of Iowa and New Hampshire. He wins Iowa, and then he goes on to win New Hampshire. Remember, he's a Massachusetts poll. Like I say, they tend to play pretty powerfully there in their neighboring state. Romney does that, then writes a check for a huge amount of money to himself, and he's able to compete through the rest of the field, maybe even win the nomination. With Giuliani, it's slightly different. With Giuliani, he can afford, his campaign says, to lose Iowa and New Hampshire. I tend to disagree. I think if he lost the first two states, it's very hard for him to kind of say that he's still the front runner
right.
and go into the South where he has his own issues.
I think today the National Right to Life group threw its weight behind Thompson.
That's right. And this gives that endorsement actually is a good way to segue into the alternative view in the own Weekly Standard offices about what's going on with the GOP. Like I said, there's the Fred Barnes two-man view, Rudy and Romney, and then there's the alternative Bill Kristol view, which is the five-person race between Giuliani, McCain, Romney, Thompson, and Mike Huckabee. And in Bill's view, this is a wide-open race of five people, and an endorsement by the National Right to Life Committee of Fred Thompson, which I think was unexpected by many parts of the party and people at large, kind of shows that he's not out of this race yet, that he actually may still be a player. And, of course, Mike Huckabee, if he were to win Iowa or even come in a very close second, he still has a chance. Mike Huckabee seems to wear well with mm-hmm. voters, where Hillary, as I was saying, may not wear so well.
I just disagree with you on that. I think Mike Huckabee makes a tremendous first impression, and over time, when voters realize that he's for completely getting rid of abortion in all cases, and that he's a creationist and so forth, I think it's going to be very hard for him to. When once it gets down to the substantive level, his good-natured, winning personality can only carry him so far. Whereas, as I said, I think Hillary, the view of her was so hard. The public image of her was so bad that she's and she's so much better than her old public image that there's still a ways to go before people kind of the market gets right on that one.
With Huckabee, too, of course, you're absolutely right. You know, the press seems to pick one candidate every cycle that they fall for, and they fall for big. In 2000, most famously, it was John McCain. And I think the press is actually falling in love for Mike Huckabee this time around. And they like his charm. They like his communication skills, which are impressive.
I like him, too. I think he's terrific.
He can tell a joke. He has a great personal story. But as you say, there are huge vulnerabilities there, among them the fact that really those social issues, which you're right to suggest he is truly to the far right on these social issues, they're also the one thing that really ties him to the Republican coalition. If you look at other things, such as, for example, economics, you know, the Republican tradition of free market economics and typically pro-business rhetoric and policy positions, Huckabee separates himself from that.
Right.
And then also on national security, Huckabee, of course, at a recent GOP debate, was quick to say, listen, you know, it may have been a mistake to have gone into Iraq at this moment, but we still need to stay there, quoting Colin Powell. And this is his way of differentiating himself from the not insignificant numbers believe it or not, in the Republican coalition who still think Iraq was the right thing to do.
Right.
Foremost among them, Rudy Giuliani, who probably, along with John McCain, gives the most convincing answer about that, or at least the most forceful answer on the question of whether Iraq was the right thing to do. So I think you're right that Huckabee may be for a rude awakening, which actually a Huckabee victory in Iowa is probably the best scenario, I'd say, for Giuliani going forward, if he can still place in those top three in Iowa.
Yeah, that could look. If I were advising the Democrats, I would say fear Romney more than Giuliani. And most of my friends don't think that's right. They look at Giuliani and his glibness and charm and 9/11 bona fides and the polls and they look at Romney and they say he's such a transparent phony and he's flip-flopped and so forth and he's a Mormon and the evangelicals think that's a cult, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I guess I have some sense that the public is unlikely to be... Well, I just think Romney will be a more soothing figure to the general electorate than Rudy Giuliani will.
You know, and I know many liberals, actually, who think exactly like you do. But I think Republicans and Republican primary voters aren't necessarily thinking that way. You know, in an age of political polarization...
I can only hope so.
Anyway, in an age of political polarization, the most calming candidate isn't always the one that wins.
Right.
And, in fact, Giuliani's specialty, I believe, is the politics of polarization. It is setting himself apart from whoever his opponent is at any given moment and then going after that opponent relentlessly.
Right.
And if he can convince the GOP electorate that he is the best chance to stop Hillary Clinton, which so far he seems to be doing a pretty good job of doing, of making that argument, then he has a real shot.
Though not in Iowa and New Hampshire.
No, not at the moment. But as we say, you know, a lot of those people haven't made up their minds yet. So, there's no question that I think, actually, my personal view, the GOP race probably will be greatly affected by what happens in New Hampshire. Because when you have the three tickets out of Iowa, like one of the contributors to the Campaign Standard likes to say, you have those top three tickets out of Iowa, and then you're probably only going to have two tickets out of New Hampshire. And Giuliani better hope that he has at least two of those five tickets, or
right.
else the show's over.
You know, you haven't mentioned the Weekly Standard's all-time, long-time favorite candidate, and that's John McCain. Do you share David Brooks, who has written, I guess, today that McCain's character is showing brightly, and that don't write off his candidacy?
You know, it's an interesting argument for David to make in this piece in the New York Times today, because you know, he was talking about the strength of McCain's character. And many conservative primary voters, one reason they don't like John McCain is actually his, or what they view as his character. That is, they don't like these personality flaws. You know, I'll talk to people about why they don't like John McCain, whom I personally like very much. And they'll say, well, you know, his temper, or, you know, he just likes ticking off conservatives. Those are all, seems to me, character arguments. Whereas in the middle of that column, David actually lays out a series of policy positions that McCain has adopted over the last few years that I think make him the strongest candidate against Hillary Clinton in a general election. You know, the fact that he was one of the first voices to go after the culture of wasteful spending in Washington. He was one of the first voices to go after Jack Abramoff and Republican corruption. He went after the corrupt Boeing contractors.
And by the way, I want to commend your book to our audience about Abramoff and the Delay Project. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you, Paul. And of course, also David kind of alludes to this, but I think the fact is John McCain has a very strong argument to make to both the GOP primary electorate and the general electorate at large, that whereas 4 years ago now, most Republicans were standing pat with alongside this Bush Rumsfeld Abizade policy in Iraq of search and destroy missions, Iraqification, and trying to leave Iraq as quickly as possible. He was the guy, as early as the late summer of 2003, arguing for more troops in Iraq, and the adoption of a counterinsurgency strategy to target the enemy, and but also protect the population, which is foremost. He was arguing for that. That's finally the strategy that was adopted or enunciated by the president in January 2007, put in place and in action in mid-year, in June, and now starting to show, I think, some real results. So for all those reasons, I think McCain is the most formidable general election opponent of Senator Clinton.
Well, you know, the Washington Monthly put John McCain on the cover and said he should run for president as a Democrat. This was back in, what, 2003, 2004. So I agree that he's a very impressive man and has taken positions that many liberals can support, certainly centrist liberals. But of course, what turned everyone off in the center left was the degree to which he had to kiss the rings of all the interest groups and mullahs on the Republican side and show himself to be a partisan correctness and lost the luster of straight talk that impressed so many of us and. It is a measure of what the primaries, especially this year on the Republican side, does to candidates. And I think, you know, that is going to make it difficult for any Republican to win in this next round, frankly. I don't know if you agree, but that's my view.
Well, I certainly think that the political climate at the moment is very hostile towards the GOP. There's no question about that. And listen, all the polls show that if the vote were held today, we'd have a president who was a Democrat, and we'd have a Congress led by more Democrats than we already have leading the Congress. But the vote isn't held today.
That's right.
The vote is held in about, now under a year, and a lot can happen. A lot already has happened. I would say, actually, Republicans are in a better place than they were certainly at the beginning of 2007. And so it's a question of what kind of place are they in toward the end of 2008. And at the bottom line, the way that I look at any presidential contest, Paul, is, you know, it's between two people. And there are a lot of voters in the middle who may find that they've been leaning in a Democratic direction over the past few years as the war in Iraq grew increasingly unpopular and it became more difficult for people to understand what exactly the United States was achieving there. But not to mention the numerous anti-Washington stories, the counts of Republican corruption, the fact that Bush really lost his connection with the American public as a result of Katrina, and people have not, the entire electorate has not forgiven him for it since. However, those voters that I'm describing, these alienated voters who have broken away from the Republican Party, they're going to look now in 2008, and they're going to have to decide between two different people. Both, I think, the Republican candidate as well as the Democratic candidate, saying that they're the agent of change. And that's really where, gut attributes, personality characteristics, they're so important in politics but often underrated by political writers, will come into play. The ability to tell a joke, the ability to seem like a normal person. All of these things may actually, I think, help the Republican nominee in 2008.
Well, let's presume the Republican nominee is the guy at the top of the heap right now, and that's Rudy Giuliani. Does he really strike you as a normal person?
Well, in a way, Giuliani's a slight exception to this argument because his abnormalities are what make him, in many people's views, heroic or great. What Rudy is going to be riding on, though, however, is his likability. And his likability ratings among Republicans are very high, I believe in the neighborhood of around 70%. And so normality and likability are two different things. Also note, I did see another poll this weekend, which showed, you know, they asked which Republican candidate would you most like to spend a few days in a car trip with. Giuliani was at the top of the heap. So, yeah, I would never argue that Rudy Giuliani is a normal human being. I'm not even sure he would argue that. But I do think he's a likable one, and that might help him in the end.
But is he a tyrant? Is he an authoritarian? You know, this issue has come up again and again. A number of pieces have pointed this out. Most recently, a cover story by Rachel Morris in the Washington Monthly, as it happens. The view is that, yes, he's a bit of a hothead, and he's got, you know, some authoritarian tendencies and so forth, but he sure shaped up New York, and really he's a kind of a kick-butt take command guy and you break a few eggs to make an omelet. But if you actually think about the situation that we have now in this country of you've had a presidency that's really staked some extraordinary claims of presidential privilege and extraordinary claims of secrecy. So things are happening within the federal government that we don't know about, and the argument is you can't know about, and I have powers that I don't even have to show you. And you have at the top of the Republican ticket somebody who, for his two terms as mayor, was famous for strategic lawbreaking, for huge levels of secrecy. At one point, he denied a Freedom of Information request, looking to see how many Freedom of Information requests he's denied. He failed to refuse to give out data that had been routine before on the level of water in the city's reservoirs. Putting in half-qualified or unqualified cronies in positions of power, and the concern that a lot of us have is, you know, we already have a presidency that's stretched the limits beyond the limits of the Constitution, and do you really want Rudy Giuliani to stretch it even further, which I think he will?
Yeah, and I think that may make, I disagree whether, you know, he will or whether we have an administration that's really stretching the limits of the Constitution, but I think the point that you're making, that this will be a campaign issue, is certainly the case. But I want to talk a little bit about this idea that Giuliani is an authoritarian, which is not only, I think, implied in Rachel Morris's article, was, of course, the subject of a cover story in The New Republic by John Judis recently. I spent some time with Giuliani last week, and I had a long discussion with him about his views of government power and freedom and such that will appear in the Weekly Standard next week. But what I took away from this interview was that the best way to describe Rudy Giuliani is not as an authoritarian, but as a legalistic disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who truly puts the law as the be-all and end-all. Now, as you say, there have been instances where he will go out and break a law to see if it's if he can't stretch it. He will take a law to the maximum position, the maximalist position, in order to achieve his goal. But there's always a case where Giuliani defers to judicial authority. And there are ways to control what he wants to do, because at the end of the day...
There's a slogan. Sometimes he'll defer to judicial authority.
All the time, yes. He defer... The reason I use sometimes there is because there are often times, like when a legislature will come in, and for the example, after 9/11, when Giuliani and the polls both wanted the extension of his term, truly an unprecedented feat, he was checked in that instance by the legislature. And not a judge. So that's why I said sometimes deferring to judicial authority, other times deferring to legislative authority. This is the correct way, I think, to understand Rudy Giuliani, is that he will submit to authorities other than his own, but they have to be based to his view in law. And he will carry out the law to the ends that he sees appropriate. And that's where the disciplinarian function comes in. Because, of course, you can't really say Rudy is a moralist because of his personal life. I think he takes moralistic positions in terms of, you know, criminals or the existence of evil, which we talked about in this interview. But the real way he views it is, you broke the law, and you're endangering others. You need to be disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way to protect others, is by disciplining those who violate the law. So that's the disciplinarian element of Giuliani's personality. You combine that with the legalistic element of Giuliani's personality, and you have this governing philosophy, which I think is, I'm not sure it's been seen on the national stage before. It was put to New York, it was useful in New York, and it achieved some very fine results for New York City.
Certainly in the first term, I'll agree with that.
Yeah. And those gains were continued during the second term. People turned against Giuliani because of some of his other activities, his whole lifestyle crusade, for example. But we've never seen this type of thing on the national stage, and it would be an administration, in my view, it would be an administration that would be forever going to court.
Yes. And I think this is where maybe, I agree that your label of sort of legalistic disciplinarian fits what I know of his career better than perhaps authoritarian, which is a baggy term. But in practice, I think it would amount to somewhat the same thing. You know, the founders created separation of powers, but one needs some minimal regard for those separation of powers for the system to work. And if you are a determined and aggressive litigant with the power of the executive behind you, you can cow the forces on the other side rather easily and wind up doing a tremendous amount of damage. You know, the separations of powers, there are a lot of weak spots in that, and one has to worry about someone fully capable and indeed deeply willing to exploit those weaknesses. And that, to me, is Rudy Giuliani. He'll just go months and ignore subpoenas until a higher court enforces them. He'll disregard the plain letter of the law to buy himself a year or two before the forces of check and balance force him into it. So I think if you put him into the White House, I don't think there's any denying that the tendency of we'll just say a extremely aggressive presidency will accelerate rather than decelerate.
Yeah, just two quick points on that. One, you know, the separation of powers works three ways. I mean, every branch needs to know its appropriate role, and I do think you can make persuasive arguments that not only the executive, but the judicial and the legislative branches have gone outside of their role over the last generation or so. And so in this case, there is an argument for a strong executive to assert his or her authority. And I think it's just equally as likely that a President Clinton, President Mrs. Clinton, would use her authority to the maximalist position as well. Because the three branches are in constant tension. And the second point about Giuliani is, you know, these tactical decisions that we're talking about and labeling various names, right? You say tomato, I say tomato. At the end of the day, they are put in the service of a remarkable effectiveness. The ability to achieve results in government that really haven't, certainly in the New York context, this was the ungovernable city, right? I mean,
right.
No one expected that these things could happen. And I think Giuliani does have a persuasive case when he says, he doesn't put it in these terms, but these are the terms in which I will put it. Perhaps you need an executive like Giuliani with such a forceful and unusual personality and also an understanding of the mechanisms of government and the law that many people do not possess, for example, the current occupant in the Oval Office. You need an executive with that in order to exact change upon the government. And see, what I see with the Bush administration, for example, very highfalutin ideals and a great desire to change the way that government operates and enact reform, say like in the intelligence services, but a complete ignorance of how to actually achieve those goals. And so what we saw is that every, for example, Porter Goss sent over the CIA to reform the place, he was kicked out. Paul Wolfowitz sent over to the World Bank, he was kicked out, just because they didn't quite know how to achieve their desired results. And I do think Giuliani can make a persuasive case that says, listen, you might not like it all the times the way I achieve these goals, but these goals will be achieved. So the question is, do you agree with them or not?
Well, that is the question. And I think that in the context of New York in the early 90s, you know, the forces that needed to be dealt with were essentially liberal forces. There was a political correctness and unions and bloated bureaucracies and so forth, and you needed somebody like Rudy Giuliani to get in there and get something done. Whereas the forces of darkness in Washington that need to be dealt with are, you know, out-of-control lobbying and defense contractors and incompetent, you know, homeland security and out-of-control secrecy and so forth. These are not the things that you want to, I think Rudy Giuliani is going to be a reformer about. These are the kinds of things that he is going to throw a cloak of secrecy over and put his people in, and you know, put his foot on the accelerator on. And so, you know, if I thought that the talent of the man matched the task at hand, I might be persuaded. But it's almost the opposite.
I think one thing we can agree on, though, with regard to Giuliani, is that he would be a president who would not lower the temperature in Washington for exactly the reasons that we're discussing. You know, Barack Obama, for example, one of his great arguments is that he's the candidate not only of change, but also kind of a whole transformational shift from baby boomer politics to a new form of politics that's a little bit more reconciliatory. Whereas I think even like, say, a John McCain or even a Fred Thompson, for political and personal reasons or personality-based reasons, they would lower the temperature, the partisan temperature in Washington. McCain, because he's excellent at both having his core right beliefs but also reaching out to the left on certain issues which they appreciate. And Thompson, for a personality reason. If you spend any time observing or with Fred Thompson, it's clear that this is a pretty laid-back guy. He has a certain view of things. He is definitely a conservative. But he's not really an in-your-face type of guy.
Right.
Much more laid-back.
Well, look, the truth about polarization and the heat of Washington is that about 90% of it is the result of the radicalization of the Republican Party under the rise of movement conservatism that saw bipartisanship is the same as date rape and wanted to crush the moderates in their party and push forward a revolution of conservative values and policies. And so you have a president like Bill Clinton who presided over a southern conservative state with centrist policies and just did fine, leading to and trying to do the same in Washington, leading to polarization. So whether Washington becomes more or less polarized is really up to the, to my mind, up to the conservatives and the Republicans. But I would make the argument that I think you're right that a Fred Thompson or a John McCain, maybe a little less John McCain because he polarizes his own side a little bit, but they might be able to lower the temperature. I think Barack Obama absolutely could. I would think Hillary Clinton could. Look at her record in the Senate. She's worked extremely well with members of the other party. And this was the great achievement of her term as senator. I want to hit one more subject here.
Paul, we actually have to wind this down.
Yeah, exactly.
So one
exactly.
More. Okay.
So this is the last thing I wanted to ask, and that
absolutely.
Is, Matt, have you started your Christmas shopping?
No, I haven't, because there's one way I do my Christmas shopping, Paul, and that's at the very last second.
I found a fellow who agrees with me on this. My wife has started it. I think it really is one of the great male-female things. I don't yet know what I'm going to buy. I'm going to figure it out in the last week, and I'm going to execute it in the last day or two. But for those out there who think differently, get going. We need your spending to keep the economy from tanking. So, Matt Conetti, it was great to chat with you.
Thank you, Paul Glasses.
Talk to you soon.
Yep.
Bye bye.